Highly placed positions and important positions with the strategic positions within the governments of the Gulf countries and within the within the market economy of the Gulf countries and business leadership leaders and big companies of the Gulf countries. The Indians are placed there. They've got access to information, and the intelligence cooperation thus is providing. I mean, they are at one hand getting the sophisticated equipment, the advanced equipment from Israel, the hardware from Israel, and in return they're providing, it seems, they're providing manpower to the Israelis, which they lack in the Gulf countries, to gain this intelligence. And you know, the Israeli spies who were caught in Qatar recently, which you've just questioned me about, are an example of this fact that they were all Indians.
The relationship between India and Israel has often been described as an outcome of the convergence of two hate-driven Islamophobic ideologies, Hindutva and Zionism. Therefore, the BJP-ruled India's growing military and strategic ties with Israel are seen as more ideological than pragmatic. With the Persian Gulf region becoming the extended neighbor of India, both in terms of geographical proximity and strategic influence, it has become all the more necessary for countries in the region to prevent the Hindutva-Zionism alliance from inflicting damage. It will also jeopardize relations between India and Persian Gulf countries that have taken years to formalize.
The Indians have got a huge influence because of their market economy and because of the trained manpower, skilled labor they provide to the Gulf countries, which is required by them, which is an utmost requirement for their economy, one. And second, because the Indians are in strategic partnership with the U.S. right now, and the Americans hold the dominant influence on the Middle Eastern countries. So, and at the same time, the Middle Eastern countries, the Gulf countries, are also playing on both the sides. They want to keep everyone happy. They want to keep the Americans happy, the Israelis happy. And obviously, Indians are taking advantage of this particular situation, and they don't really fear an outlash because of what they are doing right now. I've told you the reasons.
So we looked at Netanyahu's comeback and the relations between the Indian Premier Narendra Modi and the Israeli leader. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Journalist Pia Kutz cites an Israeli official as saying that India and Israel enjoy good relations due to personal relationship between Modi and Netanyahu, but adds that it goes beyond the personal level. Sidhan Sibal, a New Delhi-based journalist, says Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi extended congratulations to Netanyahu on election victory, adding that the two sides celebrate 30 years of ties this year. A medical doctor, Asaf Bahaya, points out that 8 former senior Indian naval officers were arrested in Qatar for spying on behalf of the Israeli spy agency under the name of fake company called Dahara.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Amid a rapidly exacerbating global energy crisis fueled by the war in Ukraine, Pakistan may also be staring at acute natural gas shortages this winter. The crisis has deepened this year in the country, with officials fearing that natural gas supplies may be limited to households in winter. Experts opine the fifth most populous country, which has been grappling with political uncertainty, soaring inflation and forex crisis, is left with no other option but to ration natural gas supply this winter.
The rapid surge in global gas prices fueled by the simmering war in Ukraine has pushed liquefied natural gas prices to record high in emerging markets. It has forced Pakistan, which is already reeling under a debilitating economy, to pay the most ever for spot shipments under long-term contracts, or even relinquish them altogether. Experts believe this shortfall means the country will suffer long power outages over the winter.
I think the first thing is that Pakistan has domestic gas, but it is not enough to meet its industrial and residential needs. So Pakistan, like many other countries, is a net importer of natural gas. And if it cannot import enough natural gas, then obviously it cannot meet the needs of its industrial and residential quarters. And I think that's exactly what is happening, that because of a bunch of reasons, Pakistan has been unable to import sufficient amount of natural gas. And that's why I think they're predicting that there will be extreme shortage, both in the industrial and the residential sectors. There are two main reasons why they won't be able to import natural gas. Number one, that there is shortage in the international market because of so many reasons, particularly the Ukraine war at the top of it. And you know, there are sanctions on Iran and Russia. So I think there's because of Ukraine war and then because of the sanctions, the international market of natural gas has been rigged for shortage. And poor countries like Pakistan, they suffer the most because, number one, they don't have the money to buy expensive natural gas. And number two, you know, enough natural gas is not available.
Over the last decade, countries such as Pakistan built natural gas strategies thinking that the fuel would be available in abundance and at a cheaper price. This year, however, the strategy failed as the liquefied natural gas rates soared. The options before Pakistan to address the issue of the gas crisis include purchasing it from Iran and Russia, the two countries under U.S. sanctions. So far, Islamabad has treaded cautiously, but reports suggest that it is now seriously considering both gas and oil imports from Iran and Russia. There are also indications suggesting that Pakistan is looking to proceed forward with the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India natural gas pipeline project to overcome the energy crisis in the country. Pakistani media reports say the country's officials have been visiting different regional countries for the past month to find a solution to the gas crisis.
Pakistan will suffer a lot because Pakistan, you know, does not have enough energy. I mean, energy comes primarily, you know, for modern industries in the form of electricity and natural gas. Now, you need natural gas both for consumption and for running the industries, as well as for generating power. So if you don't have enough natural gas, you won't be able to produce electricity. Because of the shortage, I think the industrialists, they are worried that they won't have enough natural gas to run their machineries, and therefore they will be out of business. So I think their concern is extremely legitimate. The other fundamental thing that must be, you know, kept in mind is that Pakistan does not have foreign reserves, which means they do not have enough dollars and euros and other hard currencies. I mean, they're always at the brink of, you know, default. And so people, particularly the suppliers of natural gas, I think if they have a choice to give it to Pakistan or to Germany, or to Germany, because they think that Germany has, you know, much more, you know, reliable capacity to pay them for the natural gas, but Pakistan does not. So Pakistan seems to me in a big trouble because of so many things have gone wrong. And on top of it is that they don't have enough foreign reserves, which means that they spend more dollars than they get through their exports. I think the exports are very, very low. I think most of the foreign reserves they get are through workers working in foreign countries, particularly in the Gulf states and in Europe. So I think the lack of foreign reserves is a big factor in not getting natural gas. And obviously the Ukraine war has complicated, you know, a lot of things because of the tension between Russia and the West. The natural gas that the European countries was they were getting, you know, it's no longer available. So they are turning to the Gulf states and to other, you know, suppliers of natural gas. And I think the suppliers would rather give natural gas to European countries than to countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh. So it's pretty bad situation that you don't have the foreign reserves, you don't have market credibility, and number three, there's shortage of natural gas because of the Ukraine war. And therefore, the poor countries will suffer the most. And I think that's, you know, that adds to the problems of Pakistan.
The gas crisis in Pakistan is combined with domestic political instability and a fledgling economy amid stern warnings from rating agencies that the government must take hard decisions to avoid default. The country now finds itself at loggerheads, unable to import energy at the current skyrocketing prices. The country's depleting currency and rising liquefied natural gas prices have impacted finances, with foreign exchange reserves down in October to the lowest level in more than 3 years.
According to a report, at least 78% of households in Pakistan have no access to natural gas, while exploration and production have significantly decreased in the country. Pakistan Institute of Development Economics, in its recent search on the gas crisis in the country, said the country's indigenous oil reserves will be exhausted by 2025, with circular debt in the gas sector crossing 1.5 trillion rupees, citing politically influenced allocations and monopolistic business operations as bottlenecks. Natural gas and imported liquefied natural gas contribute more than 40% to the country's current energy mix, including gas resources used in electricity generation.
Let me first explain that there are two methods to import gas from foreign sources. One is through pipeline, which is on-ground pipeline that transports gas from the source to the country where it is needed. The other method of transportation is by ship. So the source country, they liquefy the gas, put it in a ship, and then the ship takes that gas to the country where it is needed, like Pakistan, and then that liquefied natural gas, called LNG, is regasified, which is pretty complex process. So always, if you have a choice between pipeline gas and liquefied natural gas, you would always prefer pipeline gas because it's cheaper and it's less complex. Because in the case of liquefied natural gas, first you have to make it into liquid, and then you have to regasify it. But in the case of pipeline, it is much easier to transport gas without liquefying. So Pakistan has two choices. One is to get the pipeline gas from Iran, which is the neighboring country, or to get it from Turkmenistan, which is on the west or northwest of Afghanistan. So if Pakistan gets natural gas from Iran, then there are only two parties, Iran and Pakistan. The source, which is Iran, in Pakistan, which is the user.
Large parts of the country remain unexplored due to security concerns and precarious law and order situation. The political instability in the country has also aggravated the gas crisis. The incumbent government has blamed the previous administration for the crisis. Pakistan's Petroleum Ministry officials claim that Imran Khan's government opposed gas import and failed to bring the cheapest available liquefied natural gas at the time, which impacted domestic gas production in the country. High spot rates for liquefied natural gas have discouraged many buyers in Asia, including Pakistan. All activities in the gas sector in Pakistan remain firmly under government control.
Political instability is a big factor. I think it seems like Pakistan, ever since its founding 75 years ago, it is always on the brink of economic collapse and at the brink of political collapse. The political system has not worked. And I think frequently the military, they intervene and they disturb the political system. And then they also disturb the economic policies. So I think because of lack of political stability, the economic policies cannot be pursued.
And that was Pakistan's gas crisis amid soaring inflation and the harsh winter ahead. Now let's take a look at what people had to say on social media.
Afzal Kamal, a broadcast journalist, quotes from Dawn editorial that if Pakistan wants to tackle the gas crunch, it must focus on early domestic gas discoveries or continue to ration gas. Indian business journalist Dipanjan Chowdhury writes on Pakistan's impending gas crisis, noting that the increase in energy demands and depleting resources have led to crisis at hand. Burke Shah Zeb, a political activist, says Pakistani finance minister is busy holding consultations for next army chief, while the country's largest default risk reached 80%. Inflation is at a record level and massive gas load shedding is planned.
We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
اگرت چشم خدابینی ببخشند نبینی هیچ کس عاجزتر از خیش.
In a famous Persian poem we read, if you are given the divine eyes, then what you see inside yourself is all a needy person. In our religious traditions, we are recommended to avoid suspicion and pessimism towards Allah. The Holy Prophet of Islam stated, the biggest sin is pessimism about Allah. Being pessimist means consider Allah, for example, as an oppressor. This pessimism towards Allah is nothing but a satanic thought or a type of ignorance. That is because there is no imperfection in Allah, and He is the source of all perfections. All knowledge, wisdom, power, and mercy are rooted in Allah, and His attributes are unlimited. Therefore, Allah has no shortcoming, and we humans cannot be pessimist about Him.
کسی که سوء ظن به خدا داره بدبین هستش هیچ رحمت خدا رو نمیتونه جذب بکنه هیچ چیشو.
The person who is cynical about Allah cannot at all absorb His mercy and kindness. Now, this does not mean that Allah does not send His mercy to His creatures. No. This means that such a person is incapable of absorbing Allah's favors upon himself. If you threw a ball in the ocean, no drop of water will enter the ball. This is because the ball is enclosed and has no place to absorb the water. However, the ocean is still full of water. Allah's kindness is like the ocean, limitless and forever. The person who is pessimist about Allah cannot absorb Allah's favors and mercy. When a person has no hope in Allah, he cannot reach Allah's blessings too. Therefore, we must not be pessimist about Allah's mercy at all. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In 2002, during the Second Palestinian Intifada, the Zionist regime began constructing the separation wall, the total length of which is expected to be 712 kilometers upon completion. According to reports, 85% of the wall is being built inside occupied Palestinian territory, leading many to conclude that its construction is aimed at annexing more land. In this regard, we have provided world media views about this issue. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, Sakina Al-Gharib, 74, remembers when she first moved into her white stone house. It was more than 40 years ago, soon after marrying her husband Sabri, who died in 2012. Nestled on a hilltop near their occupied West Bank village of Beit Ejiza, just north of Al-Quds, Sakina would wake up each morning and look out at the rolling hills of olive trees lighting up under the rising sun. We were the only family on this hilltop, Sakina told the Electronic Intifada, adding, it was very quiet and peaceful. We used to be able to see the Mediterranean Sea from here. It was the perfect place to raise our children. The family built this home in 1979 on 100,000 square meters of land, which has been in their possession since Ottoman times. Now, however, the fabricated regime of Israel has confiscated almost all their land, and their home is surrounded by an 8-meter-high iron fence. The hills of olive trees have been replaced by villas, 2 or 3 stories high, built for Israeli settling in the area in violation of international law. Sakina said, "We are in a constant state of fear and insecurity. We feel like at any moment, Israeli troops can come and arrest us or destroy our home. It's like we are living in a prison." There is just one entrance to the Gharib family's home, with a cement corridor giving way to a tall iron barrier separating the family from Israeli settlements surrounding them. Cameras are pointed at the entrance of the family's home, a gated structure of cement and fencing. More are mounted under Israeli neighbors' homes, facing the Gharib family's one-story house. The iron fencing around the Gharib family within the ever-growing Israeli settlement surrounding them is just one part of the labyrinth of fences, bypass roads. There is even a tunnel that severs access to their lands in this area. On the way to the family's home, driving through Beit Ejiza's village center, posters and large banners displaying image of 36-year-old Muhammad Awad are pasted on shop windows and draped across homes. Awad was a teacher and father of three who was shot and killed by the Zionist regime forces in September. The tributes to him are visible reminders of the Armenian settler violence that has shaped the lives of Palestinians in this village over several decades. According to Saadat Gharib, Sakina's 41-year-old son, the Zionist regime began the process of confiscating the family's land almost immediately after his parents built the home. In 1979, 12 years after the Zionist regime took control of the West Bank following the 1967 Six-Day War, makeshift containers have already been erected near the family's lands, where a few Israeli settlers established themselves. The settlers would at times approach Saadat's father, Sabri, with requests to buy parts of the land, offers he promptly refused. Saadat said they offered him a lot of money, but my father consistently told them that this land was not for sale. All the Israeli money in the world would not be enough to buy even a meter of this land. And then the drama soon began. In 1983, the Givon settlement was established and the Zionist regime cabinet attempted to confiscate 25,000 square meters of the Palestinian family's land. The case went to the Zionist regime's high court, but in 1993, this was postponed after the Oslo Accords were signed by the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the fabricated regime of Israel. The Oslo agreements established the administrative division of the West Bank into areas A, B, and C as a transitional arrangement pending a final status agreement. Area C, which makes up more than 60% of the West Bank, was put under full Israeli regime control. Despite granting the PA control over administrative and internal security matters in parts of the West Bank, the Zionist regime maintains ultimate military control over the entire area. The Oslo agreements were meant to set the stage for peace talks brokered by the U.S. regime, with the objective of negotiating a two-state solution. Instead, they left the Zionist regime in complete control of the Palestinian economy. The Zionist regime has since rapidly expanded its settlements throughout Area C of the West Bank. In 1993, the year the Oslo Accords were signed, the population of Israeli settlers in the West Bank, excluding occupied East Al-Quds, was 116,300. Now the number of Israeli settlers has exploded to more than 465,000, with a further 230,000 settlers in the occupied East Al-Quds. Through the Oslo negotiations, the Israeli regime was able to confiscate 168,000 square meters of Beit Ejzaz land, about 6.5% of the total village area, to make more room for the Givat Ziv and Givon settlements. According to Saadat, his late father Sabri traveled to Gaza three times to meet leaders, then chair of the PLO, to plead with the leader to protect his land from the Zionist regime confiscation during the Oslo negotiations. In the end, the 40,000 square meters where the family had managed a small farm growing wheat and barley was simply confiscated by the fabricated regime of Israel, bringing an end to the protracted court proceedings. Over the years, the Gharib family has been squeezed into a tiny piece of their land measuring just 400 square meters. The Zionist settler population of Givon has grown to 1,250. With Givat Ziv, the other settlement in the area, the total number of settlers is some 12,000. In 2002, during the Second Palestinian Intifada, the fabricated regime of Israel began constructing the separation wall, the total length of which is expected to be 712 kilometers upon completion. According to Israeli rights group B'Tselem, 85% of the wall is being built inside occupied Palestinian territory, leading many to conclude that its construction has little to do with security and is instead aimed at annexing more land. According to Saadat, owing to protests and a battle in the Israeli courts, the village was able to freeze the wall's construction in Beit Ejiza until 25, at which point the building work resumed. According to rights groups, the wall extends 2 kilometers onto Beit Ejiza's lands and isolates 980,000 square meters of the eastern part of the village on the Israeli side of the barrier. When the Zionist regime's wall reached the Gharib family's home at the end of 2006, around 100 Israeli troops also arrived. After prolonged confrontations between the family and the troops, Sabri, who was then in his 70s, along with Saadat and his brother, who were both in their 20s, were arrested. Sabri had a stroke during the ordeal, his health taking a turn for the worse. The men were released after 6 months to find their home surrounded on three sides by a 1-meter-high cement wall and tall iron fencing, 8 meters high. The enclosure only has one narrow passage out to the village center and neighboring Palestinian communities. Saadat said, "I felt so much pain when I saw the enclosure." Straddled on his lap, he said, "I also felt anger because you cannot do anything about what is happening to you. We don't have a big army like them to protect us. We are powerless against these injustices happening to us by Israelis." In addition to being enclosed into a fenced enclave, bordered by rows of Israeli settler homes, the 60,000 square meters of the rest of the family's 100,000 square meters piece of land also ended up on the Zionist side of the wall. For generations, the Gharib family had planted grapes and olive trees on this land. They can now only access it for a few days each year for grape harvesting and olive picking, and only with an Israeli regime army permits. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency wrote, the Zionist regime occupation forces on November 23rd raided the village of Beit Eksa, northwest of occupied Al-Quds, where they searched Palestinian homes and assaulted the dwellers following the blast that targeted a bus stop in nearby Ramot settlement. Eyewitnesses said forces raided and searched several homes in the village and attacked residents, including journalist Ahmad Hababe, who works for Palestine TV. The village was sealed off by Israeli regime army since early morning hours. The village, home to at least 2,000 people, is segregated from other neighboring Palestinian villages by the Zionist regime separation wall. Non-residents are not allowed to enter the village without obtaining a special entry permit.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your queries regarding the upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Well, Brother Miqdad, in our previous sessions, we have been talking about the animation world, the games world, and what kind of worldview they portray and how a parent should be aware about that. You gave us a few examples. I want to ask you, is there any more worldview that's being portrayed, or are there more examples you would like to add?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we've been talking about bringing awareness to parents as well as youth about the dangers of the screen. So screen being animations or video games or cartoons or movies or serials, whatever it is. And we said that the first thing that we need to understand is that we need to be concerned, right? Okay. What we're going to do about this is another discussion. It's a different chapter in this book. But the first thing that we want to do is really understand and be aware that this is something concerning that we need to be aware of, that we cannot by any means leave our children on the screen unsupervised for hours long without knowing what they're getting involved in. And just saying that there's no adult content in it is not sufficient at all. So in the previous show, we talked about how the screen is an education. It's not just pure entertainment. In most of the time, at the very least, we can say in most times, in most circumstances, the screen, so video games or animations or serials, are not pure and just empty entertainment, but rather it's an education. It changes the way we think. It changes our values, our goals, our principles in life.
Yeah.
And so this worldview, how it's changed, we talked about a few examples in the previous show. We talked about Moana Entangled in the theme of girls being free.
Yeah.
We talked about sandbox game like Minecraft.
True.
To give a couple more examples and then move on, the example of how we define or how we understand the importance of success and how to get to success.
All right.
So one of the themes that you find that's portrayed out there that changed our worldview mm-hmm. is this attitude of, or this is this theme that luck is very important and that we don't need as much effort as we need luck in becoming successful.
All right. So it's your fortune that will take you, that will define your destiny.
That's correct.
All right.
So you find that today's culture is kind of governed by this idea that we all want to become a millionaire overnight.
All right.
So the whole worldview out there is effort is good, but we're always chasing this overnight millionaire. That something will just lucky, something will happen out of luck and we'll just get to something. And you find that this then goes into other areas, not just material areas. And you find that, for example, just to give an idea, if you look at all the superheroes that we have out there, right? So Ben 10 and Spider-Man and Superman and what you name all of them, you find that in 90% of the superheroes, if not all of them, their human perfection, or let's say the perfection that they have, is never out of an effort that they've made.
All right.
It's always out of a luck. So whether they found a watch, or they were bitten by a spider, or they came from a random place, or something random and purely fortune happened to them that made them achieve a type of perfection that other human beings don't have.
All right.
And so this is completely opposite to what we say in Islam.
Real life.
Yeah, or in real life as well.
Yeah.
So in Islam, we have this idea that it is efforts that lead you to perfection, right?
All right.
وَلَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. Human being doesn't have anything except what he gains through his efforts, through his actions.
Exactly. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift
to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we're discussing about animations, video games, and what kind of effects these screens have for children, or what kind of world view is being portrayed. Yes, Brother Miqdad, you said so far that we are being introduced to the games in which girls have to be free, they have to go against all the norms, all the beliefs, all the ideas and values. And there are games that show you there's no purpose in life, you have to design it yourself. And we also came to the point that you have to wait for luck. Fortune defines your destiny, it's not much of your efforts, which is very opposite to what is being taught in Islam.
So these were three examples that I gave. So on this last example, if you look at, perhaps somebody might ask, but what about the Ahlul Bayt, for example? Haven't they received this human perfection from birth? And the answer is yes, but it was based on their efforts as well. It is based on the fact that Allah knew that they will perform the best of actions in this world. So even in the case of the Ahlul Bayt, their human perfection that they've achieved, and them being true superheroes, it is not out of luck. It is rather out of their actions that they commit and they perform in this world that leads them to that highest level of human perfection.
True.
Inshallah, you can refer to more on books of Aqaid, but this is the true Islamic worldview, that what human perfection we can achieve, how to become superheroes, how to be successful, is through our effort and not through luck. So this is another example. Another example we can talk about is this idea that everything is material, and there is no reality other than material reality. So this is a very common thing you find in all, if not most of the things that we interact with on the screen, because the producers of these animations and video games and serials, etc., are from a secular background. They're from empiristic and modern background, which means that they believe that reality is that which is sensed in with the five senses, and that we have no reality beyond that which is material.
All right.
So just to give an example, in Ice Age, right? Ice Age 3, if I remember correctly, heaven, how is heaven portrayed? Heaven is a world, a material world with material pleasure, right? Take the example of Up, where you find that they, throughout the movie, throughout the animation, they're searching for this heavenly garden, you would call, right?
Okay.
Not only to realize that that wasn't what was important. What was important was what they had in this world.
All right.
So at the end, if you remember the end of the animation, they come back to this world and say, that which we have was very beautiful. That which we had in this world was very important.
All right, then actually reversing the concept
exactly
that is being taught in Islam. All right, there's more to talk on this, and we'll talk about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about video games, animations, what kind of effects it have on children, and what is the Islamic worldview. Well, Brother Miqdad, in our previous episodes, you talked about a few things that were changing the mindset of girls. You said that there are a few games that show that girls, the definition of free is being defined as girls must go against the norms, against their parents, against the beliefs that they carry or their parents have, against all the rituals that are existing in their societies, against the values. I want to ask you here, what does Islam say? Does Islam restrict girls?
The answer to that is no. So obviously, the Islamic idea of success for a woman is the same as a success for a man, because success in Islamic terms is not gender limited.
Okay.
So the human perfection that a man can achieve is the same perfection that a woman can achieve. So, and you have examples and role models for that in the Holy Quran as well. So Hazrat Zahra is obviously a pure role model for human perfection that is achieved. She is the same as Amir al-Mu'minin. She's Kuf for Amir al-Mu'minin, Imam Ali alayhi salam, which means that their human perfection is at the highest level that can be achieved. The Holy Quran, for example, you have the example of Maryam alayhi salam and the wife of Fir'aun, both of whom are role models for not just women, but believers. In the Holy Quran, the word that is used for them too is that both of them are role models for believers, men and women. Doesn't make a difference.
Doesn't make any difference.
The gender in terms of human perfection has no is not a limitation. However, when it comes to the path towards achieving that perfection, because the world is such that there is differences in these two genders when it comes to the material world. So
yeah,
responsibilities at the level of society. Family, etc., are different. Therefore, the path upon which both of these genders have to track on might look different in some ways, and this will lead to laws being also different for men and women.
Exactly.
Especially when it comes to laws that are related to society, just because there's differences between them, but that which they can achieve is the same in terms of that high level of perfection.
Exactly. And also about these two pious ladies, Surah Tahrim says that it's not necessary that a woman to be a role model has to be a wife of a prophet, because Maryam was not wife of any prophet, and Lady Asiya was wife of Fir'aun. So they can be role models as such, like on their own, independently, reaching that highest perfection. Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.